Lots of new faces coming along to this meeting tonight. It's nice to know that people are interested in Europe. Anyone would think there's an election coming up. If you've been reading the paper, if you've been listening to radio or watching TV, you've probably heard nothing about it whatsoever. But come along here tonight and you'll hear all about the European election. You'll hear about what we've got to say, why we're standing our candidates, and why we think we've got a chance of actually getting an MEP elected this time round. We actually came less than 1% away from getting our first MEP in the region last time. Some of us have been working very hard this time round, and I think we can do it this time round. I'm John Lucas, I'm the coordinator of the local party in Bath. We've got two speakers tonight. On my left, this is Molly Scott-Cato. She's our lead candidate for the European elections for the Green Party. And on my right is Dominic Tristram. He's the parliamentary candidate for next year's general election in Bath. I'll do a few housekeeping before we get on to the meeting itself. So if the fire alarm goes, and we obviously hope it won't, you can go out either the exits, you can go out that door there and through the front door there, which is unlocked, or you can go out the way you came in through the door there, and we gather over by the Abbey in the square over there. If you need to use the toilets, there's a disabled toilet just through that door there, and there are toilets on down the staircase through there, on one on the landing and more down in the basement. Right, now, a little bit about the European elections before we get the speakers talking to you. If you're going to vote in the European elections, you need to be registered. And one of the problems we have is that so few people are registering at the moment to vote. If you know people who aren't registered, or if there's anyone here who's actually not registered themselves, we do have registration forms in here to be filled in, and you can take them to the Guildhall. The last date for anyone to register to vote is the 6th of May. So if you know anyone who hasn't registered and you want to encourage them to do so, take away a form, give it to them. 6th of May, it has to be back in at the Guildhall for the electoral office. There is a campaign being run by 38 Degrees to encourage people to register. There will be a lot of people going around the streets on Saturday putting forms through letterboxes and going back to collect them. If you're interested in getting involved in that, you can see Barbara Gordon, who I can't see, there she is, sat down there, and she'll no doubt give you forms for that.
Does it have to be the Guildhall, even if we don't live in
Bath? No, this is just for Bath and North East Somerset, so you're in West Wiltshire.
We are.
Yeah. We also want you to be putting up posters for the election. We want to be very visible. There are posters starting to go up for the other parties, and we want to get posters up for ours. We've got a list on the door over there, on the table there, for people to sign up if they're willing to put posters up. That can be a poster in the window, or it can be a poster on a board in your garden, something large, if you've got access to a billboard or whatever. Do please make use of that. At the end of the evening, you'll get a chance to have a chat, and you can put your names down then. And we will also be making a collection at the end. Obviously, we're having to pay for the room. The campaign itself costs a lot of money, so we'll be asking you to make a donation, and there'll be buckets over by the door for that. Okay, let's go on to our first speaker, which is Molly Scott-Cato. I'm very pleased that she's come along tonight. She lives in Stroud, where she's a councillor, the lead Green councillor on Stroud Council. And she's spent the last several months now travelling around the region, visiting every town probably in the region of the southwest, I think by now, talking about why she wants to be an MEP and what she's going to do when she's elected for us. So over to you, Molly.
Thank you very much, John. I don't think I can claim to have been absolutely everywhere, but I've certainly been quite busy over the past few months. And in fact, it's a tremendous privilege to stand for election in this really beautiful part of the world. I'm sure politicians say that all the time, but I can say that with complete authenticity and confidence because it's an absolutely amazing region. I came back from Plymouth yesterday, past that fantastic bit of line along the coast of Dawlish there, and it's just so many beautiful places to visit, and as John says, I've been to quite a few of them by now. So it's obviously a special day today, so I've decided to talk about the date today and a few other dates which I think have some significance and arrange what I wanted to say about Europe. Ah, yes, that's because we're going to the pub tomorrow, John, isn't it? We're going to have Farage tomorrow and have a picture of me with a pint with a bit of luck by the end of the day. Anyway, so three special days, and you'll find out why as we go along. So the first special day is today, and that's St George's Day. Now, I'm sure quite a lot of Greens have some trouble with patriotism, and here we are in the Quaker meeting house, and I myself am a Quaker, so I ask myself questions about what patriotism means and what it means to be patriotic as a Green and as a person who's committed to peace. This time last year, I was actually in South America, as some people know, and we had a very difficult planning application coming up on our local council. A developer wanted to put 140 houses on a really beautiful part of the Slab Valley, which I felt very attached to, and actually in my ward. And I couldn't actually be at the planning meeting, so I was very distressed about this, so I wrote something before I went. And what I wrote, I thought, was what patriotism really means. And I began by quoting the First World War poet, Edward Thomas. And actually, this Monday, I decided to take a trip to Adelstrop. I don't know if anybody knows that. It's a village, well, a small town, perhaps you'd say, just on the Gloucestershire-Oxfordshire border. And it's famous because Edward Thomas wrote a poem about it. And the poem was about the extraordinary beauty of nature and the peace that was there. And the poem was written in 1913. So in this year, that's the centenary of the beginning of the First World War, it's particularly poignant to visit it. And what I wrote in the piece that was read out at the planning meeting was a comment that Edward Thomas himself made when asked why he fought in the First World War. And what he did was just bend down, pick up a handful of soil and show it to the person who'd asked him the question. And he said, you know, this is what I'm fighting for. He just demonstrated that. He didn't say that. It's about a commitment to your local place, a commitment to the beauty of your natural environment. And I think that's what patriotism means. I don't think it's about going around the world kicking other nations. It's about loving your local place. And I actually don't have a problem with that. So that's what I think about on St George's Day. And also, interestingly, if we think back to 2012 and the Olympics and the song Jerusalem, and Jerusalem kind of made real in that amazing opening ceremony, nobody in this country objected to that. Nobody said, no, that's not what we're like. You know, we're not a beautiful country that was kind of crushed by capitalism and then found itself again in the National Health Service. Actually, people agreed that is our national myth, and that's a national myth I think we can all be proud of. I try to develop that a bit in my work around bioregionalism and valuing your local place and gaining your resources that you need for making a good life, whether that's your food or your furniture, from your local place. And I call that falling in love with your native soil. And I think that's fine. I think it's a way of being patriotic that we can be comfortable with as Greens. But what I think we need to notice and be very clear about is that that local place, that beautiful environment that we have here in the southwest, would not last very long if we were to leave the European Union. And the reason I say that is that the kinds of protections of air quality and water quality and local places that we gain from Europe, we just take those for granted now. We just think that that's a natural part of life, that nobody would want to destroy that countryside. But that's very, very wrong. If you look at the planning policy of this government, the National Planning Policy Framework, you can see very clearly that there's an agenda for developers there. There's an agenda for just building on any patch of green as long as it makes a profit. And at the moment, the European Union is defending us against that. And I would be very anxious of how long that would be defended should we leave the European Union. The introduction to the National Planning Policy Framework is actually really interesting. It tells you that we have to have sustainable development. But then it asks itself the question, well, what is sustainable development? It says, well, development is growth. So you end up in a position where you've got this oxymoron, this impossibility of sustainable growth. And that's the only kind of protection we would have if we were left with a Tory government and a Tory Lib Dem government, and even, I would hazard to say, a Labour government in this country. I don't believe we can trust our environment with any of them, and that's why I feel safer within the confines of the European Union, within the legal frameworks of the European Union. And basically, what we're left with is the sort of Tory position where we say we're going to renegotiate the deal. That's where David Cameron's at. He wants to renegotiate our relationship with Europe. But what he's arguing for is renegotiating the relationship on exactly those kinds of protections, on exactly the sorts of protections that stop corporate business from just letting rip in the countryside and polluting and all of the stuff that the Greens and the European Parliament have got through in legislation to protect us. That's exactly the sort of where the renegotiation is going to happen. So we would see a growth agenda, we would see an agenda for development and for profit, and not for the citizens of Europe. So, you can come back to me with what you think about my interpretation of patriotism. It's taken me quite a long time to feel comfortable being patriotic, but I've managed it at last. So the second reason today's an important day is that it's actually Shakespeare's birthday. I'm sure you all knew that as well. I'm sure I've got a very educated audience here this evening. And you all knew that Shakespeare was born on St. George's Day. So I started asking myself the question, how would Shakespeare vote? And you do that with Jesus as well. Jesus is obviously somebody who's going to vote green. You know, he's got the sandals and the long hair. Just no question. I say that comfortably in this particular Christian room. So how would Shakespeare vote? Interesting question. I mean, obviously there's a lot of stuff in all the plays about the beauty of nature, you know, the Forest of Arden and all those sort of magical forces of nature. So he starts to feel a little bit like a green, I think. But then I was a little bit worried by this bit from Richard II, which refers to not just this sceptred isle, but this fortress built by nature for herself against infection and the hand of war. This precious stone set in the Silver Sea, which serves it in the office of a wall or as a moat defensive to a house against the envy of less happier lands. I had this horrifying thought, oh my God, perhaps Shakespeare would have voted for UKIP. No, I can't believe that's possible. But then I started to think, well, I tell you how I can refer to Shakespeare tonight. I don't need to worry so much about that. I can talk a little bit more about all those sort of tyrannical villains and people who've misused political power. I think Richard II probably was one of those, but Richard III definitely was, and so was Macbeth. So let's think about Shakespeare's portrayal of the tyranny of unaccountable political power. Because that's what we're really suffering from in this country today. I think we've got absolutely disgraceful, unrepresentative politicians. Actually, we're finishing off our manifesto right now. The Green Party manifesto for the European elections is just about complete. And we're really proud of it. I think one of the reasons we can be particularly proud of it is that the other parties just simply won't be producing manifestos. I mean, you know, we're rather traditional as Greens. We think that you tell people what you're standing for so that they know who to vote for. The other parties, I'm afraid, are treating the electorate with contempt. They make specious, emotional appeals, and then they do whatever they want after the election. And I think because, as a result of that, our democracy is in a very sad state. People are being encouraged not to vote. They're being encouraged to not take their democratic rights seriously. But I think, I mean, John's quite right to say it's very important to get people registered, to get people to vote, not just in this election, but in national elections as well. And it's very important to encourage young people to vote. Because the strange thing is, people think it's somehow cool to give away that political power. But who do they think is gaining from that? Anyway, we are clearly committed to democracy in Europe, so we are saying, yes, absolutely, let's have a referendum. Let's trust the British people to make the choice about whether we should stay in Europe or not. And we're absolutely confident about our ability to be able to make the case. I've already started to make that case here tonight, and that's what I'm doing on these platforms, saying, yes, of course it's in our national interest to stay in the European Union. We're not afraid to give people that choice. But at the same time, we say there are problems with the way democracy works at the European Union. We're calling for changes to the EU institutions. One of the most serious changes that we see, that we call for, one of the most serious problems that we see in Europe is the extraordinarily strong power of corporations. We're seeing Europe being driven by corporate interests rather than in the interests of citizens. And so we're arguing that there must be much stricter controls between people working to lobby the corporation, people working as researchers and for outside interests, for corporate interests in Brussels, and then people that actually work in the Commission. We need to stop the revolving door between those two. We also think that the democratic representatives that we elect to Europe in the Parliament should be given greater power, because the way the Constitution works, actually the Parliament is the weakest of the three political bodies, I would argue, and it doesn't have the power to start legislation. So we're arguing that, MEPs should have the power to initiate legislation. And we're also, as Greens in Europe, we're also arguing very strongly for much greater protections over our digital information and stopping the kind of snooping that's going on. So those are just three examples of the ways in which Greens in Europe are working to protect our democratic rights every day. And perhaps most importantly from a Green point of view, and perhaps from a UK Green point of view, we want to have that word subsidiarity taken much more seriously. I don't think we need to use that word necessarily, because it's not a very appealing word, it's a bit of a Euro word. But nonetheless, the concept of subsidiarity is a sort of Green concept. It's about exercising power at the lowest appropriate level. Now again, we can contrast our position here with the position of the Conservative Party, because David Cameron is arguing we need to bring powers back to Westminster, but he's not arguing that they should go any further than that. Whereas as Greens, we would argue, no, we need power at a much lower level. Let's take power down to the local communities. Let's have more power within the regions of this country. We don't want power getting stuck at Westminster, particularly with the kind of politicians that we've got there. And we're also arguing for the end of these dangerous secret trade talks that are taking place at the moment. How many people know about TTIP and the secret trade talks? That's pretty good. That's nearly half, I would say. It's starting to get out there now. People are starting to realise what's going on. And I think in order to stop TTIP and to stop this dangerous trade treaty and the constraint on democratic power that it represents, what we need to do is talk about it. There was a very similar proposal back at the turn of the century called the Multilateral Agreement on Investment, and it was stopped. It was stopped because citizens across Europe said, no, that's not fair, that's going to limit our democratic rights, we don't want it to happen. And eventually, actually, we were saved by the French government, I must admit. And this time the German trade unions looked like they might block it. Anyway, what's TTIP about? It's about extending the single market so it includes the US as well. It's about saying that the standards that we've got in Europe, for example, standards on meat production, so we don't have hormones in our meat, those standards will be threatened because we will now have to accept meat produced in the US under much lower standards because we will become a single market. And it also has proposals for defending corporate investment so that if a democratically elected government changed the law in a way that undermined corporate profits, the corporation could then sue the government to get some recompense. So that's a very fundamental undermining of our democratic rights, I would argue. So anyway, these things need to be changed. We are certainly not arguing that Europe and the European Union is perfect as it is, but we are absolutely arguing that it's in our interest to stay there and to argue for change from within. That wasn't really very much about Shakespeare, that was just a little hook, you have spotted that. So, my third important date is tomorrow, 24th of April, and that's because that's my daughter's birthday. And it is important for me to remember my children, because they're the reason I came into politics. They're the reason I decided I have to get stuck in. I have to try and make the world a better place, and I have to make it a better place for them and make them a safer future. I've already said that I think Europe does represent that future, and actually young people agree with me. Even though if you look at the polls for people wanting to come out of Europe, it's about 50-50 across the population. The people for staying in Europe are slightly ahead now, but it's more or less 50-50. But as you move down through the generations, staying in the European Union becomes much more popular. So most young people think that their future's with Europe, and we agree with them about that. One of the key reasons that Europe is important to protect our future is because it's a sensible place to act on climate change. Although governments in this country have claimed that they're leading on climate change, I think actually that is a realistic claim when it's made by the European Union. We all, most of us in this room anyway, will be very disappointed at the progress that's been made, or the lack of progress, in actually concluding an international, a global treaty. But nonetheless, Greens in the European Parliament have worked very hard to ensure that we do have binding reductions targets. So we have an EU-wide carbon emissions target, but we want to increase that. So at the moment, we're arguing for 60%, but we want to increase that to 90% carbon reductions by 2030. And we think it's very important as well that we have a binding target for renewable energy. This is something that our government shamefully and particularly shamefully, I would say, for Liberal Democrats and their energy minister, has lobbied against in the European Union. They've been lobbying against a target, a binding target for renewables, and we think that's the only way that we're going to make the swift transition to safe, clean electricity that we need to see. And we also think that we need to work urgently to achieve a global agreement, because however well we do in Europe, that's not going to be enough. We need to bring the other countries of the world in and focus very much on Paris summer next year and get a global agreement. Now, those of you who've been following the campaign in great depth and very closely will know that we launched an exciting report called Southwest Energy Region at the end of last year. And actually, it was really nice as a Green to be able to share a good news story, because the transition to renewable energy is a really good news story for us here in the Southwest. We are actually the leading region in Britain. No, in England. Scotland is ahead of us. But in England, we're the leading region in terms of installed capacity for electricity generation from renewable sources. And it's obvious because we're stuck there out in the Atlantic. You know, we have wind, we have solar, we have extraordinary marine resources. And these are all available to be exploited, to be developed, to provide the safe, clean electricity that we need. The reason that's not happening is just a lack of political will, and we can maybe debate exactly why the government is blowing hot and cold over this, but that's giving such a negative message to the very people who might develop those resources for us. The week before last, I'm a bit like one of those American tourists now, thinking, you know, it's Wednesday, it must be Bath, but anyway, I think it was the week before last, I was down in Cornwall, and I met lots of people working with community-owned renewables, and they were very excited about the opportunities, but I got that message from everybody. It's not working because the government is not showing commitment. It's giving inconsistent messages, and that's what's undermining the investment. So that's another reason we need more Greens in Europe. We need those binding renewable targets, and we need our politicians to come under pressure to actually take forward that renewable agenda, because it's not only good for our children's future, it's also good for jobs right now here in the South West. OK, my last date, yesterday, 22nd of April. It's obviously really important because it's just 1 month now until the election, which means the most important date of all, which is the 22nd of May, obviously, when you're all going to go and vote. As John's already said, we can actually win this election. We only need 1% more to get me elected, go off to Brussels on that wonderful gravy train. No, go off and serve you all, making things better, protecting our future in the European Union.
Right the first time.
You can wait till it's your turn to speak. Yeah, I'm going to finish by just reading you the last part of our manifesto, because we finished that today and we're very proud of it. So, here we go. As Greens, we believe that Europe is our common home and our future. In a globalised world, facing the daunting social, environmental and security challenges ahead, we need to work in partnership across Europe for a peaceful, secure and sustainable future. We need an economy based on fair shares and cooperation, rather than competition and profits for the few. We need to ensure that we focus on the quality of our lives rather than economic growth, and that our economy respects ecological limits. The Europe we believe in is not self-satisfied, but ambitious. We refuse to condone failure in European policies, but are optimistic about the possibility of changing for the better, not just walking away to isolationism. To safeguard our common future, we want to change Europe. We want to strengthen it. That is why we stand for a Europe where security and sustainability actually mean something. And we welcome you to join us in our vision of a Europe for the common good. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Molly. Right, our next speaker is Dominic Tristram, on my right. Dominic is our candidate in the general election next year for the Green Party in Bath. And he's also already had one success in an election. He's been elected as a governor for the Royal United Hospital, and he stood on a very clear Green Party ticket when he achieved that election. And we look forward to seeing his second election next year. Thank you, Dominic.
Thanks, John. As John says, I am the PPC for the general election, but since this is a session about Europe, I'm not going to dwell on that. Anyone is welcome to ask me about it after the talk. But my other role as one of your elected hospital governor is a bit more interesting for me in this context, because The NHS and health in this country is tied to Europe in many ways. Now, as somebody who is generally pro-European, this puts me in a slightly difficult situation when people ask me about it, because given the ongoing privatisation of the NHS by the coalition government, this opens up the NHS to competition law, which is European law. Now, yes, that is Europe, in some ways, being a threat. But what should we do in the face of that threat? Do we leave Europe and then somehow just stop that European Commission law applying? Or do we, as part of Europe, try and reform it and get that competition law not to apply to healthcare? Now, of course, that's perfectly possible. There are industries that are exempt from competition law. One must consider what would happen if we left Europe. What the parties pushing us to leave Europe want is an NHS that is market forces driven and privatised. So if we did leave, actually the NHS would be less safe. I would say that being part of Europe certainly lets us, the Greens, as a large group in Europe, we've got a much better chance of legislating for protective status for healthcare than we have outside Europe. Europe also is interesting when it comes to healthcare and science and technology in general. For my sins, I've worked in science since leaving university. And as anyone who is in a similar field will know, that almost all grants you get are European grants. Science and technology is done at a European level to a large extent in this country. This is especially true of pharmaceutical work. What would happen if we left Europe? Well, yes, we have got pharmaceutical companies, but by their very nature, these things are multinational. Would they want to be located in a UK that doesn't have the same rules and regulations as Europe? It's unlikely. Europe's a huge market for them. They would probably relocate. Speculation, true, but quite likely. European legislation is important with the drugs industry. The UK is a small part of that market. If we are inside Europe, helping to form the laws that stop drug companies from ripping us off and spending more on marketing than they do on research, which is the case at the moment, we're in a much better position. The NHS can afford more drugs, etc. It all trickles down from there. Drugs companies are just one, as I say, of the high-tech industries that we have to worry about when it comes to competing within Europe. If we left Europe, would we be able to trade on the same terms with it? We could renegotiate terms, we could set up free trade deals. But let's face it, right now, we don't have to do that. We have all the free trade we need with Europe. And we are in a strong position being part of that and being able to negotiate these trade deals for ourselves. We have a voice. It is often said that Britain in itself can't block European legislation. My view is that's good, because actually, when you see the decisions that our government makes at a European level, or deals it tries to get out of, this is not in the interest of the everyday person. As Molly said, Europe is really set up for a corporatist agenda to a large extent. We need to reform it. We need more power going to the European Parliament rather than other bodies in Europe. And the way to do that is to have representatives within the Parliament who sit in the Parliament and vote, and who actually try and get more powers in, and don't ignore it, and don't treat it as some sort of pantomime. Now, as I say, Europe to me is much more to do with my work than what I'm doing politically. But in the end, it all comes down to the same thing. Europe is there. It is an elected body, which we all take part in voting for. We ignore it at our peril. We vote for it to our great advantage. We've got more chance of a voice in Europe as everyday people, and people who don't have tons of money to spend on lobbying and corporate interests. As Molly says, we've got a good chance of getting the MEP. Let's vote for her and let's get that happening.
Thank you very much, Dominic. Right, it's 8 o'clock. I would like to finish this meeting by 9 o'clock, so we've got plenty of time for questions. Can I just see a first sort of tranche of arms going up? I can see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, oh, they're going up now. Right, if we take one or two to start off with, can I take the woman just in the middle there at the back? Yes. Thanks.
Thank you both for good presentations. I'm encouraged. I have a question for Molly, which is about international relations, militarism, internationalism. And I'd like to hear more about that from a European angle, because I don't want a Europe that's just a Europe, and I don't want a Europe that's just part of the Western bloc in military terms.
Shall we take more than one question? Yeah. We'll take one or two more questions and we'll sort of answer them all in blocks. So can I see the hands up again? So we've had one lady, so can I ask you, sir? Yeah.
I'm probably not a natural green voter. I'm a trade unionist. I'm on the left rather than green. But clearly, it's all a point. We don't have a world to live in 100 years. What can you offer me that would make me, rather than hold my nose, Greens have talked very well in other countries, but where you actually got into power, you've been a disaster for the moment. Your record in Germany is shameful, and you've been wiped out in Ireland, since we're talking Shakespeare, what is my nation, and international. They were wiped out in Ireland because if you're going to be that cynical, you can't afford to be that stupid. They went into a coalition and sold out every principle they meant to have. There has been friction in Brighton, the Bacon-Butty fiasco. What exactly can you say to me that offers an analysis that is more than purely environmentalism and more than purely saying we'll carry on business more or less as usual, but we'll just, you know, we'll all do a bit of composting and the recycling and make sure we get another 50 years of growth.
Shall I say something?
Yeah.
I think that is a gross misrepresentation of where Green Party politics is at, and I can tell that you come from the traditional left, and you could start by checking out our website and seeing what our policies really are, because they aren't like what you said. But that's fine. I welcome you to this meeting, because you're going to find out more about what Greens are like, so it's good that you're here. Now, you've started out by asking if we're on the left, and that in itself is quite an interesting question. Greens in the room will know we had a slogan which was not left, not right, but ahead. And I would say that slogan is sort of probably right for composting, but I still quite like it myself. And I don't think the left-right divide is particularly helpful now, and it's especially not particularly helpful when the parties that claim to be left and the parties that claim to be right are basically all proposing the same kind of things. And that's one of the reasons we've got a great problem with our democracy. I totally agree with you about the Irish Greens. I think they were terribly naive. I can't remember what they had one price, wasn't it, a carbon tax or something, and they went in and accepted a whole lot of stuff on the basis of one price, which they only got in watered-down form. And it was terrible for their credibility, and I think it was a very serious error. I think they made the same mistake the Liberal Democrats made, really, which is that they were shafted by more scheming political operators. The German Greens, I don't agree that they've got a completely disastrous record. I think, again, that they're quite different from where we are on a lot of issues. The issue that I'm going to come to in a minute about foreign relations and defence particularly. But I think they have achieved a huge amount in terms of moving their economy in the direction of greater sustainability. They haven't addressed the growth question, but I think the sort of transition to renewable energy that we're seeing in Germany and the rejection of nuclear would have been inconceivable if the German Greens hadn't had the sort of level of power that they've got. So I think there are some significant successes there. Brighton, yes, well, that does take up a lot of chatting time in Green circles. I have to say that the Labour Party is putting an immense amount of energy into removing us from our one seat. I only, you know, hope that doesn't mean that they lose a great many other seats, because they're focusing so hard on destroying the Greens rather than advancing their own agenda. But they are using every weapon at their disposal, including money, including their media contacts and so on, to tell a particular story about what's happening in Brighton, which isn't necessarily the true story. Now, what have we got to offer you? I think probably the most important policy is that we would make the minimum wage a living wage, so we would take people out of employment poverty. We actually have a stronger policy than that, which is about citizens' income, but that's not a particularly Labourist kind of policy, because it actually challenges the way the labour market operates. We're very strong on defending workers' rights. The Green Group in the European Parliament has an excellent record on that. And perhaps most importantly of all is the kind of work I do, which is about political economy. It's about questioning who has power in the economy, where ownership should lie. Now, to me, that's more important than defending workers' rights. That's about questioning who has the right to own banks, for example, who has the right to own land. I think these are very radical policies which would really challenge the sort of entrenched powers in our economy. And we can talk more about that later, or I can give you maybe something to read if you'd like that. Is it Diana?
Yes.
Hello. Now we know who each other is, don't we? So I struggle a bit on international relations because I always think that, you know, you do best by behaving well at home, and I think our record in the world has been abysmal in recent years, and so it's pretty difficult then to go around the world preaching to other people about what they should do. And anybody who heard Tony Blair on the radio this morning will know exactly what I mean. And I think that the European powers, let's say, have a mixed record when it comes to international relations. I don't think that they've grown up and left behind that idea that you have a right to go around the world taking other people's resources. But on the other hand, I think a lot of very good work is done in terms of working with poorer countries, working to build democracy, to build civil society in some of the world's countries where people are really struggling with that. So, and that's work done particularly by Greens in the European Parliament, and our MEP, Jean Lambert, has worked tirelessly in various hotspots across the world, you know, trying to make peace. I mean, you know, that's what the Quaker way is. It's about making peace. Peace doesn't happen accidentally. You need to make peace just like you need to make war. And I'm sure that the Greens in Europe are doing that. But some of the other action by European institutions, I agree, is much less acceptable, actually. So it's a mixed record on two.
Thank you, Chad.
Yes. That's when we moved around. I'm afraid it's unavoidable. Because...
No, it's throughout. It's when people are talking.
Oh, right. Sorry.
Trying to stand up.
I will stand up. I'm pretty sure it's when it moves. But anyway, just give me a shout if it happens a lot. I'll try and stay still. Why should somebody who is on the left vote for the Greens? Is an easier question to answer in some ways. I'm afraid I'm going to bow out of the international politics side for now, early days. But why should the left vote Green? Well, as Molly has said, we have an excellent policy on a living wage. When you just have to look at the other parties would be what I would say in summary. What do the other parties offer you? There's obviously the Conservatives aren't on the left, so you wouldn't vote for them. Obviously, UKIP aren't on the left, so you wouldn't vote for them. The Lib Dems aren't on the left. You might have a socialist worker or somebody standing, I suppose, who would be on the left. But realistically, are they going to? What are they going to do? You know, they have fewer resources than we do. We have MPs, we have MEPs, you know, we have councils. I would say, you don't have to hold your nose when you vote for a Green. We are there, we are defending the rights of the workers, we are all for protecting your rights at work, and health and safety at work, we are all for affordable housing, we are all for controlling private landlords, all the sorts of things that might tick the boxes you might have. Without knowing exactly what you want, I wouldn't go any further than that, but just by those things, we are more probably closer to the way you think as somebody who is on the left than the other parties.
Thank you very much. Right, can I see some more questions? Right, can I take... We've got quite a lot down here. Can I take this lady just here?
Okay. Right. I'm really passionate about the NHS. I'm even more passionate about the RUH. So you're a governor. Okay. So... Do you support the NHS, or would you like to see privatisation?
Wait for a couple.
Yeah,
I think you could paraphrase the question.
Yeah, we'll repeat it when we've heard the question. Yeah.
And your party, the Green Party, wants to stay in Europe, and you're one of the governors at the RUH. So, are you for privatisation or keeping the NHS?
Okay, he will answer that in due course. Can I take another question as well? At the back there?
patriotism is paying your tax. And I've been involved with the Fair Tax Campaign, and when the Fair Tax Campaign was first talked about, it was suggested that we should ask candidates to make a statement that they are not filling their tax. I mean, a lot of MPs we know are filling their tax, their offshore accounts. Would our candidates be prepared to make a statement that they don't hold offshore accounts? because we stand very little chance of changing the legislation on tax filling. We have a Prime Minister whose father was a tax cheat. You know, his Eton fees were paid out of untaxed money. So until we get this sorted out, we're just not going to get anywhere as far as cheating on tax is concerned. So that is the question. Would you be prepared to make a statement that you are not filling your tax?
Okay. Who would like to answer first?
I find that rather insulting, actually. I've got to say, I find that rather insulting that you're suggesting that I'm filling my tax.
I'm not insulting it.
We're coming to your question in a minute.
I think this is wrong.
Okay.
Did everyone hear the question initially?
It was about the NHS and whether I pro or anti privatisation of it.
If I was to give you my vote, I'd like to know that.
In a simple answer to your question, I am entirely and unambiguously against privatisation. I and the party support 100% publicly owned NHS.
Your party supports staying in Europe.
Yes, we do.
You're in a dangerous position then. But can you work that out for yourselves, everybody?
Yeah, exactly. You're going to open it up to the EU countries.
Not now, but next year. If you're going to be the parliamentary candidate, then you are you're going to be in an icky position.
It's not true. Because at the moment the NHS is exempt from the competition because it is in any industry that was or has traditionally been state-owned.
Europe does not support our NHS.
Hold on,
Europe doesn't support
the NHS.
The European law does not apply as it stands because the NHS is a state, a public body, and it is exempt from competition law right now. Now, the current government would love that to be not the case, and that's why they're privatising it. I think their agenda is to sell it all off as much as possible, and then there'll come a point where actually it'll be almost impossible to renationalise it. Now, they're not going to have a chance to do that before the next election. So at the turn of the next election, it will still be exempt from European competition law. Now, the reason I stood for a governor and the reason why I am a governor, because I won on a very strong anti-privatisation message, is because I do not think private healthcare has any place in the NHS. In fact, I would go further than that. I don't approve of private healthcare, full stop. I think there should be nobody making money from your illness. Obviously, it's wages. I mean, I'm a realist, you know. But no private company. There should be no shareholders. It should be for the people who get the best care should be the people who need it most, not the people with the most money. Okay. And that is fundamentally what I think. And
tell people what to do with their money.
The reason I'm on it is to say no to any privatisation that comes up at the IUH. It's as much as I can do as a governor to just for the IUH, but one of the reasons why I'm standing for Parliament is to stop it happening nationally. And that's my strongest reason to be in politics, to protect the NHS.
Thank you.
Okay,
shall
I do the tax one now? Okay. Yeah.
I leapt in there because I was rather offended by the suggestion that I'm filling my tax. I think it's a really sad state of affairs where when you stand up as a politician, people immediately assume you're filling your tax. Anyway, I mean, I'm happy to say I've paid all the tax I should pay. But on the Fair Tax campaign, I work in a business school and I've looked at the Fair Tax mark and I've tried to get my university to use it. The trouble is it's actually quite... you know, the accountants that I've asked about it say it's quite difficult to actually see the detail of what's behind the fair tax mark. So I'm not convinced that that's necessarily the best way forward, but I absolutely think it's very important that we pay our taxes. I have gone on record in a little film discussing the joy of tax, and every time I pay my tax, I feel very good about the fact that I'm investing in public services and in a better society. So I think tax is absolutely a great thing. I also think that one of the most important things that goes wrong in terms of tax is that too much of the burden is falling on individuals at the moment. Corporate tax rates have fallen from 30% to 21% over the past 10 years. And that's something where what happens in the single market is really important, because what corporations are doing is they're doing a shopping expedition around the European Union for the lowest corporate tax rate regime. And, well, you know all about that. So Amazon is in Ireland. There they are smashing up our roads and creating potholes, but they're not paying taxes to pay for the potholes to be repaired. That is something where the European Union should take action. I mean, it's questionable what the action should be, but I mean that... We could argue that if you have a single market, you should have a uniform tax rate. If you don't want a uniform tax rate, then you allow countries to take action to stop that kind of corporate tax shopping that goes on. Oh, sorry, I just wanted to say on public ownership. We're also for public ownership of the railways and of the energy companies as well, except we also think there should be a lot of community-owned energy. And 68% of people agree with us that the railways should be in public ownership, and 85% agree with what Dominic just said about publicly owned health.
I wasn't inferring that you're not paying your tax. What we've got to try and do is get the people who aren't paying their tax to be exposed.
But presumably they're liars as well as cheats, I guess.
Yes. That's politics.
OK, let's go on to another couple of questions. So I can see 1, 2, 3, 4. So can I take you?
Good evening. I'm coming here this evening to hear what the Greens have got to say about Europe. And I have to say that what I've heard so far, in terms of arguments, cases, etc., I can't see anything that justifies giving up our sovereignty and our freedoms to a group of unelected people that meet in secret at Brussels to formulate policies for this country.
And the stock exchange instead.
Do you mind if I have one say, sir? Thank you. I haven't heard yet an argument that justifies tying us to Europe, sucking in our money to Europe, giving us a small return. I haven't heard anything which demonstrates that Europe can do something that the British people can't do better.
We have another couple of questions as well.
You don't want to answer.
No, we'll be answering, but we're taking two questions at a time. I want to ask yours.
Yes. Molly, I was very moved by your opening comment. To do with the commitment to beauty of our natural environment and the example of the Slad Valley. My father used to live in Stroud, so I know that area is very beautiful. Now, what I think I'm slightly unsure of your party's position on solar farms, which to me are not at all aesthetically pleasing, and covering the countryside, hundreds of acres of black panels. Could I ask, would you think it would be a better policy for the Green Party to ensure that all the solar panels were put on roofs first before they were put onto productive arable land?
Okay, do you want to take that
first?
Yeah,
sure. I think I did. I mean, I made an argument. I don't expect to convince you because I think you've got a very strongly held position, and that's fine. We're in a democracy. You know, in a month's time, we're all going
to
vote.
For you.
Okay, well, you say you've come here to be convinced. I doubt that. And it was really a statement rather than a question. But what I've tried to argue is that there are two ways. Well, let's say there are three important things that Europe's bringing us. I believe that the European Union is fundamental in ensuring peace in our continent. And to me, that is a. Shall I finish before?
Sorry,
I mean, I can see you've got passionately held views, and that's fine. But you know, we can agree to disagree. That's why we live in a democracy, and I'm perfectly comfortable with that. But to me, the European Union has been very important in building peace within Europe, and I value that for myself and my children. I also think I've already argued that environmental standards are protected by Europe, and I, for one, whatever arguments you may claim for sovereignty from Westminster, I don't trust particularly a Conservative government to protect my environment, and I think the fact that the national government has been taken to court for poor standards of air quality that actually breach European levels is evidence of that. And the third aspect is what I've already talked about, which is worker rights and employment rights at work. Now, some of the regulation we've got from Europe, I mean, of course, the UK has already negotiated opt-outs from the sort of standards at work that other European citizens enjoy. But it's pretty clear to me that if we left the European Union, that's exactly the sort of rights and protections that would be undermined, and that's precisely the sort of area where David Cameron is seeking to renegotiate. So I think as working people, as people who value our environments, as people who want to live in peace, our future definitely lies in Europe. I think your question is fairly easy to answer because I completely agree with you about that. I think part of the problem with solar farms is that the government offered feed-in tariff regardless of scale, and I think a lot of people have jumped on that bandwagon, and I think if we made the payments that people received in exchange for generating electricity, if we related them to the scale of the project and also the nature of the ownership of the project, then we would get solar panels on school roofs rather than on productive farmland.
Can I just a little bit add to that? Has anybody done a calculation relating to food miles? Because if the productive arable land isn't growing potatoes, they have to be imported from Egypt or
honestly, that's a marginal consideration at the moment, and the reason we import food is not really to do with whether our land's productive. It's much more to do with sort of profit and trade and arbitrage and that kind of thing. So, I mean, I'm totally with you on the fact that we should be using our productive land for farming, but that's another area where we need to see significant reform of what happens in Europe, because at the moment cap payments encourage less than ideal use of productive land.
Okay, could I have another couple of questions? I can see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 hands here. So can I take the lady right at the back there?
Tony Blair was known as Teflon. Nigel Farage had the ability, seemingly, to just rush off any kind of attack on him. And my question is the Green Party unequivocally in agreement with the free movement around Europe? Because if that's so, then I think we're not going to do as well in the elections as you might, because I think UKIP is very real. Because nobody knows what their other policies are, but what they know is that this is a small island.
We better see who else has got their hands up. I ask you.
You both talked about democracy in the EU. I don't know if the room is aware, but our British MEPs, their voting rights are 8.24% in total. And there are 28 EU commissioners, and they are unelected. So why are we sending MEPs in the European Parliament to an unelected parliament when both Molly and Dominic have said it's democracy when it fairly isn't, and it's never been said as being democratic before? We only have 8.24% of the vote anyway, and it will decrease as countries like Turkey and Albania join. So why are we wanting that free movement, building on the Slant Valley, to house people coming into the country? In 2011, 500,000 people came into this country. Where are they going to live?
Okay, thank you. Molly.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you about the lack of democracy in Europe. I made that point myself, and I think we need to work very hard to make sure that the Parliament has more powers. The history of the European institutions is that the power of the Parliament has increased relative to the power of the Commission, and I think that's a trend that we need to encourage, but we also need to look at the other ways that power is exercised, and I mentioned the revolving door of the Commission and lobbyists, and I think that's a great problem as well, although it's also a great problem in London, so I don't think it would help to bring power back to Westminster. I think we need to be a little bit more sophisticated about how we think about how power works, because the stage at which somebody does that in a room is like the last stage in a lengthy process of how power operates, and so, you know, the fact that people are doing this in Brussels rather than Westminster is not the key point. The key point is who is really exercising power, and there the corporate lobbying question and funding people to vote in certain ways is much more important, I would suggest. You mentioned 8.24%. I assume that's the number of our MEPs, UK MEPs, compared to the rest of Parliament.
Their voting power in Parliament.
So I think that's actually a rather narrow-minded way of looking at what the Parliament's about. Because we are, as Greens in the European Parliament, we work as Europeans. That's the whole point. That's why it's protecting the peace in Europe, because it's thinking about the benefits of the continent as a whole. And so I think, again, we've got a different view of what the European Union's for and how it works, that you would bring up a statistic like that. On the question of free movement is a basic principle of the European Union that we signed up to. But having said that, when we signed up to it, the world was quite different from the way it works today. And we've seen the whole process of globalisation, which has greatly increased the amount of movement, particularly movement for work, that we see in the world today. And I think a mistake was made. And myself, I think the mistake was made when the enlargement happened about 10 years ago, because a lot of countries came into Europe then, which had much lower standards of living and much lower wages. But the left-wing governments that were in power in many European countries at that time didn't introduce any protections of working people. For example, you could have introduced something that said we'll have a transition period, and over a period of 5 or 10 years, we will equivalise wages across Europe. But we didn't do that. So without doing that, it seems inevitable that we will see this pressure for migration, which then creates a social problem and causes concern to people in various countries across Europe, not just ours. Because it's also a problem, of course, if you happen to live in the Czech Republic and all your dentists have migrated to a place where they can earn higher wages. So I think that we do see a problem with the enlargement, and it's part of the problem of great inequality remaining within Europe. Because as a club of nations, what we've signed up to is equal standards of living across the Union, and we haven't achieved that. And that's also an important political priority, because that would remove the push pressure for people to move from their home to a foreign labour market.
Do you want to add anything?
Well, I mean, Molly's covered everything quite well there. I think even taking Europe out of the equation with globalisation, there will be wage disparity. The parties that support our leaving the EU still don't want to stop migration. They will, I think it's points based or something, or based on skills, but they'll still have people coming in. So you'll still have a brain drain from poorer countries and people coming here. And technically, would they be lowering wages? Yes, probably. All the arguments you can use for the EU migration, you can use for any migration. I think we have to be sensible. It will happen in a globalised world unless you don't let people travel at all. And yes, it's about how we manage it.
Thank you. Can I see who else wants to ask a question? I can see just one at the front, one there. So,
one of the earlier speakers implied that his understanding was that the Green Party was no more than environmentalism. And I wonder how widespread this feeling is amongst the population. I have a sneaking feeling that quite a large proportion of the population might share that view. And I think it's very important that we get across the fact that we have a very broad policy, a very broad manifesto, and that we tackle many, many other burning issues, and not just, because we're green, not just environmentalism.
Okay, one other question? Down the front there. Yes, you.
Could you Could you say Europe's proposing banking reforms and also
Yes, you are right. You often hear people say, "Oh, Greens, yes, you're, I know you care about the environment, or I know you have ideas about the environment, but what else do you think?" And the way I describe the party to people, when I have to do an elevator pitch, as it were, to use a horrible marketing phrase, is that the Green Party is the party of social justice and evidence-based policy. So yes, that is how I would introduce it rather than the environment. I think our concerns about the environment and its protection are a given. And actually, I wouldn't generally bring those up to anyone asking me about the party. You're right, they don't realise that we have views on a lot of other things. And I would tend to be optimistic about this, because I don't know if you've ever seen the Vote for Policies website. There's a website that anyone might like to go to, voteforpolicies.org.uk. And what it does is it shows you all of the policies from every party, but it doesn't tell you which party those policies belong to. And you select the one you like best, basically, and you do all the policies, and at the end it tells you who you should vote for based on policy. When you do that, Greens win easily nationwide, and they win easily in Bath. We're something like 32%, and the next up are actually Labour at 10 less. So actually, if people voted for what they actually cared about and believed rather than a party, we would have a Green government right now. This is the message we've got to get over. We have lots of policies which are, Molly mentioned, our desire to nationalise the trains and the energy. These are massively supported by the public. And every chance we get, and this is one of those chances, we tell people these are our policies, and it always goes down well. And you just have to hope that if you keep saying it, it'll stick. Now, sadly, elections in this country, because of the way things work, can be won and lost on money. It has to be said, we have a lot less money than the other parties. You know, it keeps us. I mean, I like the fact that we don't have to do the bidding of our corporate paymasters, you know, like some other parties might have to. But it does mean we haven't got money to put huge posters all around the country and put stuff on TV. And so we depend on grassroots meetings like this and people just getting the message across. And the more we do it, we're building up and building up. And yes, it is frustratingly slow sometimes. But I think the message is getting out there.
Thank you.
Yeah, I had quite an interesting experience just before Christmas, because I had to get a lift into central London from where I work in southwest London and back again to do a TV thing. And so I spent, because there was fog and bad traffic, I spent like half an hour twice with two London cabbies. And I persuaded them both to vote Green by being stuck in the car. Is more or less what Dominic said, which is that you need to get somebody's concentrated attention. You know, I'm taking taxis a lot more since then, by the way. You have to get people's concentrated attention, you know, for long enough for them to actually think about what you stand for. And of course, the real lack here is our lack of presence in the media. And I really don't think that this is accidental, you know, because we are putting forward a serious alternative, especially on the way the economy works, especially on questions of ownership and control of the economy. This is very threatening to the establishment. And, you know, we would be naive if we thought they were just going to say, oh, come on in, you know, take our money and power. So, you know, it's not surprising, but it does leave us in the position that Dominic said, well, we have to tell you, and you have to tell your friends, and that's the way we're going to change the world, not through paying vast amount of TV advertising. And actually, like Dominic, I feel proud of the fact that we do that. I don't feel ashamed of that. I feel proud of that. And we have more activists working than anybody except UKIP, because they really believe in what they're doing as well. I mean, I think they're totally misguided, but they really believe in what they're doing. They have activists. And the Three Westminster Party, almost all their activists have just melted away, because they know that they're being scammed and that their parties no longer represent them. Obviously, you know that I'm the finance speaker for the Green Party, so tell me to shut up, John, if I go on too long on banking reform. I mean, the really interesting thing that's happened since 2008 is that we haven't seen banking reform. You know, it's 5 years now, more than 5 years, and yet the changes we need to see haven't happened. Now, at the European Union level, the Greens have worked really hard. They've capped bankers' bonuses. They've introduced a stronger regulation of what banks can do. And they've also stopped banks speculating on food products, for example, which can increase starvation in poor countries. And in the US, there's also been some regulation of banks to stop the very risky activities, and so that the taxpayer won't be responsible if, you know, the banks take risks and can't repay their money. But the place that's really holding it out against that is the city. And this government is so much in hock to the city, and I think as citizens we should be really ashamed of that, because we are holding back reform of banking. And it's one of the key reasons why we might leave the European Union, in my view, because the government would sacrifice our membership of the European Union and all the great stuff we get from Europe to save their friends in the city. There's a strong pressure there. The Green Party's policy is two main things. One is that we should separate retail from commercial banking, and we should stop banks doing what I think of as anti-banking, you know, where instead of lending money to small businesses so that those businesses can thrive, what they actually do is, as we've heard in the case of RBS, bidding down the value of the assets of those businesses so that they can buy them up cheap later on. I mean, it's just complete... Anyway, we don't need to start moaning about banks, do we? We won't stop. But, you know, regulation can stop that, and the government isn't doing that, and none of the three Westminster parties have committed clearly to separating retail from commercial banking, and that's the only way that we will separate the protection of the banks that we need, because our money's there, from this crazy gambling that the commercial banks get up to.
Molly, can I just interrupt?
No, you can't. No, you can't. I'm coming to that now. If you managed to not interrupt, I would get to it before you interrupted, so, because that's the last one, financial transaction tax, on my list here. The financial transaction tax is a tiny tax, less than 1% on the value of the... Actually, at the moment, it's only for foreign exchange transactions. So that's like gambling on the way currencies are going to move each other. It's completely pointless. One of the things we suggest is that all such banking activities, which are called derivatives, should have to pass a social usefulness test before they'd even be allowed. So if you can't explain to a committee of ordinary people why that's good for society, then you wouldn't be allowed to do it. And to be honest, like most of what happens in derivatives trades would just disappear if you introduce such a test. But the financial transaction tax is for the here and now. It's for foreign currency exchanges that already happen, and it's less than 1% is the proposed rate. 11 countries in Europe are going to be going ahead with that, and as a result of that, they will be generating money which can then be invested in some of the poorer countries of the world and in various worthwhile projects. So it's a tiny first step, in my view, towards getting banking system in Europe to work for the common good, because actually it's only taking a tiny proportion of their profits. But if that's the first step, then we should certainly take that step.
Thank you very much. I see some more questions. I can see one there. So, John?
Yeah, I've got a question, but I want to set the scene a bit for a minute, so I hope you bear with me. The year I was born, 1946, this country was in a real mess. One house in Philly had been damaged by bombing. They had to demobilise 5 million people from the armed forces and sort of repair the country. But that government, or the people, let's say the people, built a national health service and built a welfare state and built thousands of council houses. Now, this country is on the turning point, either the fifth or sixth richest country in the world. But what's happening is, because of the financial crisis, the politicians of all three parties are asking the most vulnerable people in society to pay for that. So my question is, and I'm a member of Bath Against the Cuts, is if the Greens get into power, what will you do about this unrelenting attack on the poorest and most vulnerable people in our society?
Can I have one more question? The front?
Yes. You've explained why there's a net inflow into this country from poorer countries, and it's a pretty big net inflow of over 200,000 per annum, says this gentleman. What I want to know is, we may understand how this came about, but have you any plans to stop this, or are we stuck with this forever? Because I think we're already very overpopulated.
It's not sustainable, surely.
Are you trying to
wax
first?
What?
Irish
first.
Yes. I'm not convinced by the statistics. I mean, I'm an economist, so I know you can cut statistics lots of different ways. The point about free movement is that the people move in different directions, and a lot of British people live in other European countries. So if we stopped movement of people, then that would also obviously undermine our rights to travel freely. But on your kind of deeper, greener point, I think that is an important point, and I think we are the only party that actually raises that question about population rather than just the question of where people live. Because to me, the question of where people are consuming those resources and where people are producing carbon dioxide is a secondary question to the fact that we just have an awful lot of people on this planet, and that is putting environmental systems under stress. And of course, the other aspect of that is that the way people live the amount of environmental stress they create depends on the way they live. So our enormously energy-intensive lifestyles are much more damaging than people living in other countries where they don't fly, for example, where they don't travel about as much as we do, or the people we used to be in the 1970s when we didn't travel as much as we do now. So I think that in terms of the pressure caused by population, we need to think about lifestyles, and we need to think about policy and population. The Green Party is actually the only party that has the courage to do that. On the question of austerity, it's a very interesting point. I mean, I don't entirely agree with the argument that says, I mean, of course, we did do all those wonderful things when we were massively in debt, but the truth is we were massively in debt, and we continued to pay off all debts to the US until 3 or 4 years ago, which is a disgrace in my view. But anyway, that is the case, and that was why people struggled through the 50s, because we were paying interest on our loans to the US and Canada for war material. So it wasn't quite as simple as, we weren't in debt, we were in debt, but we still flourished. But I think what we need to do, and this isn't Green Party policy, I have to say, but I published something recently called Can't Pay, Won't Pay with the Greenhouse Think Tank. And what that suggests is that we need to look more closely at actually who we borrowed the money from and who's gaining from the public debt. Because obviously where there's a debt, there's also a creditor. So our creditors are holding our national debt, and we are paying them interest on that national debt. And the cost of paying that interest is the very kind of cuts that you're drawing attention to. So I think we need to look seriously at our debts and where they came from. And if what we're doing is cutting National Health Service to pay the Sultan of Brunei, then we need to decide as a society that's what we need to do. And I don't think very many people would vote for that personally. What else did I want to say about austerity and the cuts? Yes, I mean, obviously, you also talked about burden sharing. I mean, there will also be some burden in terms of paying for public services, but I think, I've already discussed the way in which corporation tax has been reduced. It's quite clear that the government that we have now is working in the interest of an elite, and it isn't sharing that burden fairly. And so a Green government would certainly change the tax system so wealthy people paid more tax. And I don't know if you've seen that website. Mark Thomas has set it up. It's called willdrivethemtotheairport.com. So I think, should the bankers say that they're going to leave if they have to pay 50 or 60% tax, then you know where to go and sign up.
Yes, I mean, all I can add, it's a good example of if people threaten to leave the country, then let them. I think even without talking about raising taxes or lowering taxes or messing around with them, there are things we can do right now that would shift the burden from the poor. PFI deals and public sector contracts cost way more than they would if the state just borrowed that money. That's one thing you do immediately that doesn't hurt anyone. It saves money, and therefore we don't have to make so many cuts. Things like the bedroom tax, which have been shown to actually cost more than they've raised and have resulted in bizarre situations like 3-bedroom houses having to be demolished or potentially demolished because there's nobody to live in them. And these are ridiculous policies, which they were brought in some sort of effort to show that the poor are being punished for something they didn't do. They've actually cost more money, but this government is so ideologically committed to it that they can't see the ridiculousness in what they've done. So before we even talk about raising taxes on anyone else, we can do this. We can save some money. We can stop punishing the poor quite so much. We can get rid of ATOS doing assessments. We can get GPs to do the assessments. We pay them already. There's this madness of we must outsource everything and get these private companies in who fail again and again and again and take money off us.
We can save £55 million every single day of the year by coming out of Europe and getting rid of this...
Which we can save $100 billion over 10 years by not having Trident.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, no.
for every coming out of Europe argument you hear, you hear ridiculous arguments. Let's quadruple spending on the Ministry of Defence. Ridiculous. Let's boost Trident. Ridiculous.
I haven't said any of that.
No, but this is the parties that might have one vaguely rational point, and I'm not saying that coming out of Europe is a good idea, but you can't. It's all just tied to their neoliberal, you know, coming out of Europe from a Tory point of view, isn't really to help the people, it's to help companies, and it's to get rid of your working rights, and it's to get rid of things like the working time directive. It's, you know, don't believe that when you hear that these things will save us money, that's not the agenda, and I don't think they would anyway.
Doctors don't want the working directive. It's causing a lot of problems for doctors. You ought to know that, working for the NHS.
Let's stick to the...
You've just mentioned the EU directive. It's been in all the papers that it's going against the hospital doctors' rights. Well, so why are you sticking up for the doctors?
We'll take a tangent for a second to answer that. I would rather have, when I'm in hospital, a doctor who has only worked for a normal day and is rested, rather than one that's been forced to work 40 hours at a time or 30 hours at a time, is half asleep, is giving the wrong drugs. The NHS is safer now than it ever has been before there was minimum working times brought in for doctors. That is a fact.
Apparently, the doctors are stopping on the minute and leaving people suffering in the hospital wards because they have to work certain number of minutes. You ought to know.
Can I ask people to raise questions through the chair?
He doesn't know what he's talking about.
And we'll let people on the table answer the questions. We've got about 10 minutes left, so can I just see who else wants to answer a question? I can see one here, I can see one here, one down here. You haven't spoken yet.
You mentioned about the potential treaty with America, with Europe and America, which I'm totally with you that I think that would be disastrous. And one of the benefits I see of Europe is of having the strength to stand up to America and to stop following the lead of this highly capitalist, non-democratic huge power. And I would like to see the EU do that more. But we already have, with the EU, we already have some fairly unpalatable trade arrangements. Particularly, I would identify the trade agreement with Israel, which has been totally ignoring and disrespecting human rights for 60 years or more. And I wonder what you have to say about what you might do about that European trade agreement with Israel, which gives Israel special status, almost as though it was a European state. Mm-hmm. And whilst it goes on, carrying out what the UN rapporteur, Richard Falk, described as a
OK, Grassi, is there anyone else who's not asked a question yet who wants to answer the question? Yes, we're doing two questions at a time.
It's an interesting question online. I've never been to a talk where you ask one and then you answer the second one. I've never been to a talk.
It's hard for some people to follow. Some people can't follow two questions at a time. So.
Would you like to answer that one straight away, Mum?
Just to say, I agree with you. I think there are real problems in the way global trade works, and I think that the EU isn't setting the standards that it ought to be on a global basis. I don't entirely agree with you about the sort of EU-US thing. I mean, to some extent, yes, particularly because there are Greens there, I would argue. We have fought for high standards of animal welfare, for example, and environmental standards and so on within the single market. But in other ways, I think that our economy is very dominated by large corporations now, and to some extent, politicians are much less powerful than they should be in the EU and in the US.
All right, can I see if there's anyone else who's not asked a question?
The actual point of my question was the trade agreement with Israel.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I agree, so...
Anyone else who's not asked a question so far who wants to ask, or we'll go back to a couple of people... Sorry, at the back, I didn't see you there. Yes.
Can anything be done? Sorry, not very well known. To expose the scandal, which has been going on for about 60 years now, whereby the International Atomic Energy Authority, been in the role of trade organisation promoting nuclear power. At the same time, the fox guarding the chicken coop, setting the regulations of how dangerous radiation is, and is suppressing evidence over the last 60 years. What can be done to break this enormous scandal?
Okay, I agree. I think it is quite extraordinary. I think the origin of that kind of particular exemption from normal regulation and normal rules that the nuclear industry enjoys within Europe is because of the Cold War and because the link between civilian nuclear power and nuclear weapons. And I just don't think there's any justification for it to continue. Again, it's something where Greens are very strongly against nuclear. I mean, the German government has now decided to phase out nuclear by 2023 as a result of domestic pressure there from German Greens. And Greens in the European Parliament are uniformly anti-nuclear. And again, as isolated, really, amongst the other groups as a result of that. But in this country, I mean, it's really, I think, quite a shame, quite serious that we're just going in the wrong direction on electricity generation. And in the world as a whole, following Fukushima, most countries evaluated their nuclear program, decided it wasn't safe, and decided they were going to take a different course. But because of the power of the nuclear industry here, not to mention in Europe, and also because of the failure, I would argue, of the media to create a proper debate over this, we are seeing the threat of new nuclear development. Although, as you may know, in terms of Hinkley at least, it's unlikely that the EU will give state aid approval, which means that the price that we're having to pay for nuclear is so high, according to the deal that's necessary to get EDF to build the new plant, that the European Commission is likely to say that's unfair subsidy. So, I mean, I have my fingers crossed a bit as I say this, but the UK government doesn't have the power to decide that we're going to have Hinkley unilaterally. And the first judgment from the Commission was that actually it was an unfair level of subsidy. So there is some hope there that Hinkley might not go ahead.
What's it to do with the EU? It should be ours.
It's French.
Can I just say something?
It should be us to
decide. Would you mind me just saying to you that if you behave in a respectful way, people will listen to your views more? I completely respect the fact that you hold your views very strongly. I hold very strong views myself, but people listen to you more if you behave respectfully to other people.
Can I see if there's anyone else who's not asked a question? I can see one there and one right at the back. And I think it's 5 to 9. We'll make those the last two questions.
Can I ask a question about growth? Whenever one hears a politician from the three main parties talk about economics, the aspiration is for continuous and unlimited growth. I'm not an economist and I don't pretend to understand economics, but as a scientist it seems to me that you cannot have continuous growth in a finite system, and the world is undoubtedly a finite system and undoubtedly has in many of our traditional energy sources a very much finite source. Is the Green Party's view similar to this, that we must go for growth? If it is not, how do you intend to put over an alternative view in the light of the continuous monolithic dialogue from the Mail, Express, the Times, the Sun, the BBC?
If you'll bear with me, can we take the other question as well and answer the two together, if that's all right with
you?
Can I ask you at the back to ask your question?
What's stopping, there's a lot of
people in this country who put in their money, it's 55 million going into Europe each day. What's stopping someone new into this country, not maybe aware of really what is right or wrong, what's stopping them just getting into the car? Can cause a lot of trouble without the education, without being educated on what is right or wrong. It's just, I don't feel there's enough. It's something I've experienced in my lifetime of people that are not just aware of really what is right or wrong. People come to this country and then cause a lot of problems. Like, for example, about nuclear power, if we're trying to do something that's more small and self-sufficient, how can someone, a small family, what can we do against a big, just huge corporation, basically? People that are not as aware of right or wrong, and people that are wrong now.
Summarise what you said.
Yes, it was sort of quite difficult to summarise, but it was basically, they're choosing to live in a particular way that respects the environment. I hope I'm not paraphrasing wrongly here, but what can you do about other people who just kind of rock up and don't have the same view of respect because they're not very well educated? Something along those lines. So the growth question, obviously I spend a lot of my time trying to do exactly what you're suggesting. I mean, I am an economist. But, Kenneth Boulding famously said the only people that think infinite growth is possible within a limited environment are economists and madmen. So you're obviously sane, but I am an economist. I spend a lot of my time trying to confront that argument, but it is one of those enormously strongly held pieces of received wisdom that is entirely wrong. And it is quite difficult to argue with it. I mean, when I did the response on the budget recently, I really tried extremely hard to get as far as saying, and by the way, growth's not a very good thing. But the agenda you get set is so far away from even raising that as a question. Even when I have that consciously in my mind, yes, I'm going to be able to get to saying economic growth cannot go on forever in the limited universe. It's very hard to move from where the political debate is to that point. I think it's important that we also draw attention to the relationship between the way we create our money and the fact that we're creating a pressure for growth, because if you create money in a kind of mushrooming sort of way, then you you create it through debt, then people have to work more to earn the money to repay that debt. So there's automatically a pressure for more economic growth there. And also, coming back to the population question, there's another pressure for economic growth, which is certainly putting a pressure on the environment. Now here, I think, again, there is some hope with what's happening in the Green Group, because the Green Group is 58 people in the European Parliament. It's quite a strong group, and if the Green Group came out strongly and said and challenged this commitment to constant growth and seeing growth as an unalloyed benefit for everybody, then I think we might be able to start to move the debate, at least in the European context. And encouragingly, this time, all the Green parties in Europe have agreed a common manifesto. As far as I know, we're the only group that's been able to do that. Last time we didn't sign up because it had a commitment to growth in that manifesto. And in the 5 years between 2009 and now, we have argued successfully with the other Greens across Europe that actually growth is problematic to the rest of our political agenda. And so I see some hope there, actually, that argument may be able to be made more strongly. Now, on the question of political education and so on, I mean, I'm really worried about the state of our democracy, and I think one of the aspects of that is a complete absence of sort of political and social and even moral education. I think one of the things we can learn from the Arab awakening and the changes that we saw in Middle Eastern countries was that actually having a revolution and then putting a cross on a ballot paper is by no means sufficient to a functioning democracy. People need to understand the issues. They need to be given spaces where they can debate the issues. And one of the things actually that's really good about political campaigns and elections is that we do all come together in a room with people we don't share opinions with, and we do hear their opinions and we debate, and that's part of what political education is about as well. And I've been thinking quite a lot about what's going wrong with our democracy, and I think it's important to realise that actually it's less than 100 years that we have had this ability to vote and to choose who our governments would be, at least all adults having universal suffrage. And as I see it, you know, for some time that wasn't used very effectively, but then a vast amount of political education was undertaken, particularly by workers' movements and trade unions. And so through the 1930s, they basically, as I would see it, educated people and educated each other in what sort of a world they wanted to build. And the culmination of that was 1945, when much of the world that we've taken for granted in our lives, you know, protections at work and healthcare and the welfare state, those were introduced as a result of that political education. But, you know, we need to carry on with that project. Just as you've said, it's not something people don't remember how to operate in a democracy. And I think too many people have sort of been asleep on the job. And I think as Greens, we are doing that. We are holding public meetings. We are talking to people on doorsteps. But, you know, we all need to do that in our everyday lives, because that's what will keep our democracy alive. And at the moment, I think it's seriously at threat, actually.
But policies are not formulated by the
policy. Sorry, can I just ask you? Do you want to?
Yes, democracy. I would always rather somebody voted, even if it wasn't for me, than didn't vote at all. I went to an event organised by students a couple of weeks ago for Earth Hour, which was sort of everyone gets together and thinks about the Earth. And there may be 100 something students there who'd all turned up, and it was. And I was there as a political representative because it was an environmental event. Core Green Party voters, you'd think. Chatted them all. They all agreed with everything we said. And how many of them had registered to vote? Very few. And how many of them even saw the point of voting? Very few. This is depressing, whatever party you represent. What do we do about it? Well, I think one of the things to blame is the absolutely timetable to the minute education system we have now. There is no place for schools to do civics or philosophy or anything like that. And you need that sort of education. You need to have a philosophical, at least a very vague philosophical knowledge to be able to assess issues and ethics and who you might want to vote for. So I'd like to see that changed. I'd like to see some time set aside in schools for that sort of discussion. But obviously we can't change that now. How do we engage the people who are voters now, the young people? It's a difficult one. It's something that the Green Party would really love to do, and I'm sure all the parties would like to do it. I think the media has very much decided on the issues when it comes to elections, and they're the issues they talk to people about. And if you actually don't feel strongly about that issue, or you have one of the opinions that are acceptable on the media, then you think, well, okay, I'm part of the political mainstream. If you don't, then it's so easy to feel disillusioned. Look at Russell Brand. A couple of months ago now, I mean, I think Russell Brand is right on many counts. He's a divisive figure, but he's right about a lot of things. But where he is absolutely not right is about disengaging from the political process. Because if you disengage from the political process, nobody's going to canvass your vote. Nobody will do anything that you want because they'll know you're not going to vote. That's what I try to tell young people. If you value, if your issues, if you want those to be the things that the government legislates about, then you have to vote, because they're not going to bother if you don't vote for anyone.
Can't make change if you don't vote.
Right. Thank you very much. I think that's a very good place to finish the meeting now, because what you've got to do next is to go out and vote. You've got a month to think about it. What I'll ask you to do before that, though, is if you want to support us, and we've had a very lively debate tonight, and I think it's been very useful to have the range of questions we've had. If you want to support us, we've got a form there to sign up. Preferably, if you want to join us, there are lots of forms around to do that. We would like to have your posters going up, so if you want to put a poster up, do please sign the form there, and we'll make sure we get one to you. And we do need money to fight the campaign. We do need money to hire rooms like this. So there's a bucket at the door. Please do put whatever you can afford into that. The speakers are here for a little while yet. We'll be here till about 9:30. So do come along, come and talk to us, and do help us put the tables and chairs back, please. Thank you very much.